It's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 66, for Friday the 9th of March, 2012. On the show today, the European Space Agency is planning to launch a billion-pixel space telescope into orbit, which has 2.5 times the number of sensors as the Kepler Space Telescope that's been hunting for exoplanets. Apple unveils the iPad 3 as well, and we were at the launch event to get hands-on with the device and its new high-resolution screen. And what has 8 legs, fangs, and can produce a substance that has been discovered to conduct heat better than copper, iron, and silicon? We'll find out on today's show. Hey there, Nate Langson here. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk. Joining me, of course, news editor Duncan Gear.
Hello. I'm glad you kind of paused just before you said gear there because I needed to swallow a jelly tot.
Thanks for the information there, Duncan. And of course, associate editor Olivia _ Solon.
Hello.
Not eating jelly tots.
No, but have consumed many.
It's a shame. It's a shame. There's only 7 there left for me. Later on today, we're going to talk about the iPad 3, which went on sale, of course. And we've also got a Sony Tablet S to give away on the site. And we've got full details about how you can win that potentially at the end of the show. So, you know, don't switch off. But we're going to talk about some news first. And we might as well touch briefly upon the iPad 3. We are going to talk about sort of what we made of it in person first. We thought we'd just have a quick rundown of what it's got. It's got a big screen, high-res screen.
Duncan? Tell us about the screen.
It's a very high-resolution screen. It's like a 10-inch version of the one on the iPhone, which is to say extremely high-res. They call it the Retina display.
And why do they call it that?
Because they reckon at a distance of about 10 inches, the retina on a human being eyeball cannot discern between the pixels. Thus, it looks smooth.
And is that actually true?
Yeah, I played with one yesterday. It's really good. It is really good.
But I mean, is it scientifically true? Because I thought people had done some research into this and found out that actually it's kind of nonsense.
Well, Apple says that they have done science to support their claim, and they reckon it's true. And, you know, in practice, I can't really tell. But who am I to say? My eyes don't have a degree in science. Do yours?
Mine do.
Actually, yours do, don't they? I don't have a scientific degree. Okay, well, anyway, we're going to talk more about the iPad 3 a little later on. It's going on sale in the middle of March 16th, I think, and we'll come back to that. But let's get on to some non-tablet news. Liv, the European Space Agency, building a big old lens in the stars.
Yes, it's for next year's Gaia mission, and they want to map all of the positions. Well, not all of the positions. A lot of positions of stars in the Milky Way. Actually, only 1% of stars, but it's a billion stars or objects, they say, in the Milky Way.
Okay, and this is using a billion pixel camera. So essentially a pixel per object.
Pretty much, yeah.
Does that make it 1,000 megapixels?
That would make it 1,000 megapixels, yes. Yeah. 1 megapixel being a million pixels, this being a billion pixels.
Yeah, and the company that makes them is a UK company called E2V, and they say that their pixels are better than regular pixels. Their pixels are actually physically bigger than the kind of pixels you'll see in a consumer electronic device will be sub-micron size. But the pixels in their devices are between 10 and 20 microns wide, which makes them very sensitive to light, and they also eliminate quite a lot of the noise that is normally associated with images.
Yeah, basically you can capture much more light, which is very important when you're looking at stuff millions of light years away.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's 106 sensors about the size of a credit card, each 1,999 pixels by 4,500 pixels. And they make up this enormous 954 million pixel imaging device, which is going to be sent up 1.5 million kilometres away to take images of the Milky Way.
Now, this is pretty amazing for the reasons you've mentioned, but I also kind of like the fact that it has a 5 megabit data connection back to Earth.
It does.
From its distance of 1.5 million kilometres. That's pretty cool.
Exactly. And it'll be continually transmitting this data back to Earth, well, at least for 8 hours per day, I think, is what they're going to be doing.
Okay. I think the intention here is to understand the origins of our galaxy. And I think the theory on star formation a bit better as well.
Yes. And they say they should be able to gauge the bending of starlight by the sun's gravitational field. And that will be able to put some of Einstein's theories of in his general theory of relativity to the test.
Yeah. Duncan, are you excited?
I'm moderately excited.
You never seem to get as excited as me over space stuff.
I am excited. I just don't do it quite as loudly as you do.
A billion pixels from space.
Yeah, that's cool. But yeah. How many stars are there in space?
Well, about 100 billion galaxies in our
in the known universe.
That's more impressive than us just sticking a load of cameras up there.
But I mean, to compare it to something like the Kepler, it's got a huge amount more sensors than the Kepler. It's 106 compared to just 42. And just think of all the cool things Kepler's been discovering. Lots of exoplanets. This is going to find a whole lot more things and produce images in a much higher resolution.
So with a billion pixels, really, you're going to need an iPad 3 Retina display, aren't you? It's roughly the same resolution, I think.
Approximately. Apple would like you to believe that.
Yeah, they would, wouldn't they? Okay, let's move on. The Higgs boson, another sciencey story, but it's reared its tiny little very hard to find head again, hasn't it, Duncan? This time at the Tevatron complex.
Yes, well the Fermilab complex, which is where the Tevatron particle accelerator was, because it actually got shut down last September. But two teams there are still sifting through some of the data that it generated while it was online, and they've found results indicating an excessive events between 150 and 135 gigaelectron volts. Now, that is going to mean almost nothing to most people, but it's kind of an indication of statistical probability of where a particle might lie. And what's interesting about that range in particular is that the teams working at the Large Hadron Collider at the Atlas and I think it's CMS project, they have found an excess of events in exactly the same range. And because the teams at Fermilab and the Large Hadron Collider are looking for this particle in very different ways, well, slightly different ways, the fact that they're both showing the same results in the same location is a very positive indication that we may have found something.
Scientists aren't coming out to say that this is proof or confirmation. It's simply
another discovery. No,
it's simply another nod towards the fact that there may be something here, but no one's going to come out yet for a while. I mean, it was kind of like when we had the you remember the faster than light neutrinos that everyone started talking about, and then that turned out to be nonsense. Basically, someone kicked a power lead out of a computer or something.
I don't think anyone's completely ruled that one out yet, but they're still working on it. No, I mean, the important thing to note here is that that when you discover a particle, it generally passes a certain statistical significance level. It has to be, I don't know the exact level, but it has to be a certain chance that it is not going to be false, basically.
Yes.
And so you can't call it a discovery until that. And while we've got good results here that suggest there might be something here, we need much, much more data. And to collect that, the Large Hadron Collider is actually boosting its power recently. They announced that it was getting, I think, quadrupling the amount of data it's going to be pulling in before the end of the year. So hopefully, physicists will be able to get a definitive answer on whether or not the Higgs particle exists within the next few years.
Spider silk. This isn't science as much as it is creepy crawlies, Liv.
Well, it is science. It's spider silk. We've been quite fascinated with it for a while. It's very strong. It's very stretchy. But it also conducts heat better than a lot of very good heat conductors, including copper, silicon and pure iron. And this is a discovery by mechanical engineers at Iowa State University.
So first off, I wasn't sure what we're using spider silk for anyway when it comes to conducting heat. You know, I mean, what can we do with spider silk, for example, if we know that it can conduct heat better?
Potentially quite a few things. I mean, this is such early stages, but they're saying it could be used to create small, stretchy components in electrical circuits. It could also be used to create kind of dressings for wounds that would dissipate, get rid of the heat from the wound really quickly so that it wouldn't get all festering and sweaty, and potentially clothes that would be really good at getting rid of heat from the body.
And they did some tests where they stretched the silk as well and found that that actually increased the conductivity, which isn't what we normally see.
No, normally when you stretch a material, it tends to become less conductive of heat, but this spider silk's behaving very unusually, and it's particularly unusual because it's an organic material. And just to compare it to something like another silk, a silkworm silk, it's 1,000 times more conductive than silkworm silk. And in actual terms, it conducts heat at a rate of 416 watts per meter Kelvin, and copper conducts it only at 401 watts per meter Kelvin. So it's pretty impressive.
But still early days. We're not going to see this in new bandage technology. We're not going to see a Band-Aid with spider silk.
No, but it just means that there's another extraordinary property to spider silk.
It's good stuff. But actually, you know, Duncan, you wrote this week about spider silk being used in violin strings, guitar strings.
Yeah, that's right. A Japanese materials scientist created a set of violin strings from thousands of individual strands of spider silk kind of spun together.
Okay, and to be used for...
or playing a violin, basically. I mean, he said that what's interesting about it, it has a soft and profound timbre. And the interesting thing about it is the way it kind of compresses together, leaving almost no space between the strands. Unlike a traditional like nylon core with aluminium around it, it will withstand a lot more tension before breaking, though a very, very traditional gut string can withstand more tension, so...
Interesting how much musical instruments derive from animals, because violin strings are normally made from horsehair, and drum skins can be made from actual skin as well.
The strings, the bows are made
from horsehair. The bows are made from horsehair, not the strings.
I meant the bows.
What else is made from animal...
they use goat skin over African djembes. So all in all, though, good news for the spider world. We were all looking at Apple for innovation this week. We should have been looking under rocks.
Or in the bath, yeah. On your face.
Maybe.
Really? In your eye.
Thanks, Liv. Let's talk about tech. We've actually had quite a science-heavy intro, but we've got some technology here. And this, Duncan, I believe, is because BT and TalkTalk have lost something quite important and dear to their hearts.
I mean, this is kind of more about politics, really, I'd say, than tech. But yeah, it's about the Digital Economy Act. BT and TalkTalk have had their second appeal against the act thrown out of court. They'd argued that it breaches European laws on privacy, and that was rejected by the judges. But they did win a small victory in getting the courts to agree that ISPs shouldn't necessarily have to pay a proportion of the case fees involved in the prosecution of users who are file sharing.
Let's just rewind a little bit. What was the act proposing ISPs should have to do?
The act proposes that ISPs kind of monitor the traffic of their users and send them a letter when they do... when they infringe copyright in some way, and then after they've infringed enough, then technical measures take place.
So Liv is sitting at home downloading 9 million dodgy drum and bass songs, and this would say that they have to, you know, keep an eye on that and send a letter.
They'll send you a letter, Liv, and if you ignore that, they'll send you another letter, and then if you ignore that again, they will start implementing technical measures. And
so I become a level 3 pirate.
Yes, exactly.
Excellent.
Level up your piracy.
I see. I like the gamifying of our legal system.
Yeah.
The problem here is that nobody actually knows what these measures are yet. Ofcom did a consultation back in 2010 and sent it to the Department of Culture, Media, Sport, and they've just pretty much sat on it ever since, so we're waiting to see what happens there.
But they've had a similar thing enacted in France. The Hadopi ruling law
was
enacted, which is essentially 3 strikes. It's, you know, first you get a warning, then you get a letter, or I think you get a letter first, and then you get your internet cut off, and you can't have any internet for, is it a year, or is it more than that? It's something like that.
I'm not sure of the exact details. I mean, I would be very surprised if something like that got enacted in the UK in exactly that way. Mm. I think it's much more likely that your connection would be throttled in some way, or certain sites would be blocked, or certain types of traffic would be blocked. I think that's a far, far more likely thing to happen. But before that happens, it's possible that BT and TalkTalk might take it to the Supreme Court, though, of course, the Supreme Court can say, no, we're not going to hear it.
BT and TalkTalk here acting basically on behalf of all ISPs, because they all have the same desire.
And their users, yes, yeah. Yes, absolutely. But it's going to be interesting. If you ask me, I would be surprised if a letter is ever sent out.
Mm.
I just don't think it's going to happen. They've dragged their feet for so long now, and services like Spotify have come along that have, I mean, certainly in the music space anyway, music piracy is less of a problem than it has been in years.
Yeah, but I mean, at the moment, there is still a process. I mean, the music industry, for example, if we're going to pick on them, same is true for music or games or software. They would essentially have to get a court order to subpoena the ISP for details of where your computer is based on the IP address that you're basically making public by downloading any material. Mm. So all this stuff can still happen at the moment anyway. This would essentially just make it a process that's supported by government and make it a lot easier, I guess.
And you think
people aren't going to do that because there will be too many possible reports?
Well, I think there's that. And also that as soon as anyone gets a letter, they will just encrypt their connection and carry on regardless. I mean, it's trivial to get around this kind of monitoring.
I think as well, it gives you the confidence that if you've had no strikes and you can say, well, I can download what I want and maybe I'll get a letter. And if I do, then I'll be maybe a bit more careful.
Then maybe you'll spend £5 a month for a proxy that stops you from being monitored. So it's just silly. It's a waste of time.
Okay. Well, we'll keep our eye on it. We'll keep you posted. Very quickly, before we just have a quick ad break, is that we've had some good news this week. If you are a old school, real time
old school, it makes me sound old now.
I was playing this on the SNES back in the 90s.
We should probably say what we're talking about.
SimCity. The popular city building franchise of games from Maxis and then from Electronic Arts is coming back next year. SimCity 5, technically, although they're just calling
They're just calling it SimCity.
Yeah, it is technically SimCity 5, though, isn't it? 4 being the last one about 2007.
I suppose so. There was SimCity, then 2000, then 3000.
Then 4.
Then 4, then SimCity Societies, which was terrible.
Yeah.
So maybe this is 6.
Well, anyway, it's coming back next year. It's going to be PC or desktop computer only. I imagine it'll be on Mac as well, not consoles. And the original developer of SimCity, they're the ones who did SimCity 2000, probably one of the most well-known of them all, is going to be developing it, which is great news.
Because, it is great news.
You know, it's been a long time since we've had Maxis doing some SimCity stuff for the world.
To be fair, they've been busy with The Sims.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, The Sims, oh my God. The amount of DLC that's out for The Sims these days. I got sent a review copy for another one, Showtime or something like that. It must be the 6 billionth I've had for The Sims 3 over the last 4 days.
But what's exciting about SimCity is the changes that they're going to make to it. They're implementing, I think they said it was 100% buzzword compliant, so it's going to have, like cloud saving and the ability to visit other people's cities. And they sort of talked about a situation where if one of your friends is a heavy polluter, then that's going to affect your air quality as well, so Ooh. You can try and convince them to stop pumping out gas.
I think there's a great way for them to incorporate mobile gaming into this as well. I mean, imagine, SimCity, the whole point, for anyone who doesn't know, is that you're building up a city and you're playing the mayor who controls everything. It would be great if you could have, you know, kind of a mobile app on an iPhone or a tablet or something where, you know, if you're away from your computer, you can get real-time updates for how your city's doing, because the cloud could know the state of your city at any given time. And you could get, you know, imagine getting a text saying, riot's broken out or there's a fire, and you have to get your phone out and, oh, this is bad.
You have to block social networks. Yep.
Run to the nearest computer you can to log into your cloud and make some changes. You know, send a fire brigade out.
That's exciting and all, but what I'm most excited about is the fact that for the first time it's going to have curvy roads. You can make a road bend in it.
Couldn't you do that before?
Nope.
Corners.
You can do a corner, but it would be a straight corner.
Well, I has excitement. Do you has excitement? Let us know. podcast@wired.co.uk. Subject line, I has excitement. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to break down our opinions about the iPad 3, which we got to play with yesterday.
Wired magazine, published digitally every month on iPad. Now available to our print subscribers at no extra cost. For more information or to subscribe to the paper and iPad editions for just £2 per issue, go to wired.co.uk/iPad.
iPad 3, Retina display, Duncan Gear. These are all things.
Am I a feature on the iPad 3?
These are all things I've experienced over the last 24 hours. The iPad 3 was announced last night. I was at the event and got to play with one.
What's it like?
It's pretty much what you might expect. It looks exactly the same as the iPad 2. It's ever so slightly heavier and thicker, which is unusual for Apple, but it's barely noticeable. The most important thing, though, is the new screen. So if anyone's seen the iPhone 4 or iPhone 4S, you'll know that it's got this amazing sort of super high resolution screen that Apple calls the Retina display. And there were a lot of rumors that Apple was going to bring this to the iPad and basically make a 10-inch Retina display. That's exactly what's happened. And when you see it in the flesh, it is kind of startling how good it looks. It is not like anything I've seen. I did catch myself kind of grinning and saying, wow, when I first saw it. And that's a good sign, because I'm supposed to be not showing anyone while I'm there that I'm actually impressed. I'm supposed to look annoyed, but I was pretty impressed. So it does look good.
Apart from the screen, what else has it got?
So it has also got a new processor inside, but it is probably, and I couldn't get an answer out of this, I think the actual processing power for general stuff, so just processing apps and things, is the same as before, because it's kind of a dual core thing. But it's got this new quad core graphics element, which means that the graphics are, it says, you know, twice as good as the previous iPad. And they showed some new 3D games off. There was one called Sky Gamblers, which was kind of a flight sim.
What's a Sky Gambler?
I had no idea. Honestly, I have no idea what the hell a Sky Gambler is. I'm assuming it's, you know, one who gambles with the clouds.
It's a pilot you don't want to hang out with.
Not a clue. But anyway, I played it and it did look amazing. I mean, it's rendering stuff at 2000 and, ooh, I can't remember the figures, 2048 by 1536 pixels.
That sounds about right. Yes, you are exactly right, in fact.
Wow. I just looked it up. Top of my head as well. Which
so hang on, so what are you actually going to see then? What is the difference between playing that game on a regular screen and playing it on the Retina display?
The difference is that the resolution is massively higher, which means that the pixels are smaller and more closely packed together, and that means the image is incredibly sharp. So just to put this into context, think about a 60-inch plasma telly with a Blu-ray movie on it. That's, everyone knows that's 1080p, which means it's 1920 pixels across by 1080 pixels high. That is less than is on this 9.7-inch screen. So you can just imagine that playing a Blu-ray movie through the iPad 3, or the new iPad they're calling it, wouldn't actually be high enough resolution to fill the screen. The Blu-ray movie would have to be stretched out just to fill it.
Cool. So we've got the screen, we've got the A5X processor.
Yep.
What else do we have?
The only other thing that's massively changed is the camera. So the iPad 2's camera was, I think it's about roughly accurate to say, piss poor. It was it was not good. It was fine for FaceTime and video calling because that's what it was designed for. But, you know, it was not designed for taking photos or recording video, really. So the new one has got a 5-megapixel camera on the back with autofocus. And, you know, they call it the EyeSight camera now because it's actually decent. And I got to use that as well and see some video recorded on it. It records video at 1080p. Very, very good. Not quite as good as the iPhone 4S, though, but close. It doesn't have a flash either.
Yeah, I was going to say, it has slightly fewer megapixels than the iPhone 4S, doesn't
it? It's 5 megapixels.
5 rather than 8.
Yeah, 5 instead of 8. But it did look very, very good. Very, very good camera. So, you know, you could definitely use, if you, you know, were happy sort of holding up a 10-inch tablet, you could easily use it to take holiday photos and holiday videos on there too.
And everything else is the same? The same case, pretty much? Same battery life? The same
Pretty much. The only addition is it has 4G wireless if you want it, which we don't have in this country yet. But it's some networks in the States support it and various other places around the world. When we do get 4G in this country, they will work because it's using the LTE standard.
So overall then, is this an evolution or is it a revolution? Is it like the difference between the 3GS and the 4, the iPhone 4? Mm-hmm. Or is it the difference between the 3G and the 3GS?
I would say, it's a really difficult question to answer, right? Because it's one of these things that will be more apparent in about 3 or 4 months once app developers have had time to really get to grips with the technology, make their apps take better advantage of having all of that pixel space on the screen. I would say it is more like the 3GS to the 4 because the processing power is so much better for graphics. The screen is insanely good. And I think that those two things will enable developers to make really amazing apps. I mean, Apple's making some apps like iPhoto is going to be on there now, and that has some really good desktop-like consumer image editing features that you can do, you know, quite a lot with, and they looked really impressive. And the thing is, it's not. It depends what you're going to be using it for. I would say a lot of people have asked me over the last.
Let's do this then. If somebody's got an iPad 2, should they upgrade?
They should upgrade if they are into photography, 3D gaming, reading a lot because the text looks so much nicer on the new screen. And if, you know, taking pictures and watching movies is of interest. For those people, I would say, yes, upgrade.
If somebody's got an iPad 1, should they upgrade?
Without question, yes. But the iPad 2 is still going to be perfectly good for a lot of people. So if you're basically someone who uses an iPad to read Facebook, play Angry Birds, and look up recipes in the evening, then you don't really need graphical horsepower. You don't necessarily need a massive high-resolution screen, and you don't need a better camera on the back. So on day one, there's no real reason to rush out an update. It's just that apps will then come out down the line that really do take advantage of that processing power, and then you may feel like you're missing out. So those people may probably still want to upgrade down the line. All right, well, that's going to do it for news for this week, and we're going to move on to our feature. Now, you have to ask yourself, who is protecting you against cybercrime, really? You.
RoboCop.
No, it's not, sadly. Bear that in mind as we move into this week's feature. According to the Cabinet Office, the annual cost of cybercrime in the UK is £27 billion. Symantec last year estimated that the global cost of cybercrime was $388 billion. And in the same study, 69% of adults reported being victims of cybercrime. We're not talking pop-ups on a PC advertising porn, though. We're talking about banks having details of customers hacked and sold on the cheap to whoever wants it. Fortunately, there are companies tackling this at its source, the computer virus, and F-Secure is one such company. We've got a feature about the company in our new April issue, and its author, Greg Williams, executive editor of Wired, is here joining us.
Hello, Nate. Thanks for having me.
You went to F-Secure's lab in Helsinki to research this feature. What is an antivirus R&D center actually like?
Well, this one is a particularly nice one, I imagine. It's in a kind of rather large glass building. The area it's in is, I guess, a little bit like, I don't know, Docklands in the UK. It's a former area where there was large kind of ships used to come in. They used to offload the goods. And there's new development and there's old, very cool warehouses where they've got lots of restaurants and yoga studios and artist studios. So it's a very kind of recognisable, cool, regenerated area that the F-Secure headquarters is in. The headquarters itself is, I can't remember how many floors it is, probably about 8 to 10, I'd imagine. It's quite quiet. There's a very, very international kind of crowd there. They have people there from all over the world, from, you know, Italy and India, and everybody, pretty much every nationality you can think of work there. It's a real kind of like global hub, I guess, for talent. The floor that I spent most of the time on is actually one of the most secure floors. To get on it is actually quite tricky. You have to go through quite a bit of security, which I probably, they won't thank me for talking about too much. I won't tell you what that is, but it's not easy to get onto. The kind of the most striking thing about it actually is when you first walk into the area, there's sort of like three screens, one of which is very large, and a kind of a large conference room, large conference table, and there's kind of constant data going on the screens. It makes you feel like you're in sort of, you know, a situation room and something kind of very important is happening. Around the edge, on the edge of the building, are different offices. So some people there are doing, they're all doing kind of different parts of R&D. So some people specialise in spam. Some people are kind of the response units to whatever kind of problems they're seeing at the moment in their system. There's a unit that specialises in looking at mobile phones. So that they're all the kind of different aspects of what they do are in this one area. It does feel kind of fairly, I don't know, even though it's not unrecognisable to anyone who works in an office where there is, you know, a high level of technology, there is something that feels slightly kind of like high level to it, though. It feels slightly kind of like it's got a military edge. Having said that, I think this seems like quite a nice place to work. I one bit of data that I should probably share with you is that I didn't realise this, that Finnish people drink more cups of coffee per capita than anyone else in the world. And according to Miko, during a four-week period this year, 8,000 cups of coffee were drunk in F-Secure. They have around 500 employees. So that's an awful lot of coffee for people.
Now, you mentioned Mikko a couple of times. This is Mikko Hipponen, and he is the Chief Security Research Officer at F-Secure. Now, he seems in your feature like a pretty cheerful chap for a guy who's basically spending his day looking at a lot of computer code and trying to track down a lot of dodgy guys. Is that the case?
Yeah, you know what? I think he absolutely loves his job. I think he's really motivated by what he does. I mean, I spent the day with him. I think really gets up in the morning and is kind of excited about what he might find, about what's out there and how he might address it. He's a pretty high level guy. He works for a lot of international security agencies. He consults for a lot of people who need their data security to be absolutely kind of totally secure. But you can tell that he's just someone who just loves what he does. He's also got a great sense of humour. You know, I don't think he's one of these people who's kind of, you know, particularly kind of like nervous about kind of facing down, some fairly sort of unpleasant characters who are sort of like putting this bad stuff out there. He's got a very dry sense of humour. And most importantly, he loves to eat. We stopped twice during the day to have large meals. So that suited me down to the ground.
I want to pick a quote out of the feature, actually towards the end of your feature, I think. And this is from Mikko himself. He says, "People rarely leave this industry. We're different. Generally in the IT industry, the enemy is your competitor. In security, it's the bad guys." Now, did you get a sense of that? Did you get a feeling that they really are, they are all working together. They're calling up Symantec to give them the latest gossip rather than trying to put them out of business.
It's exactly that, Nate. Everyone shares. That's the kind of the unwritten rule. Maybe it is actually, in fact, a rule, but it's something they all do. So if they find a sample that they think looks pretty nasty, they will get it out there as quickly as they can. They'll share it with Microsoft, they'll share it with Norton, they'll share it with, you know, Sophos, all the big players, and they'll make sure that everyone is aware of this, because they act collectively, you know, as much as they're in competition with these companies, because they want to, you know, sell their software so that their clients are fully secure. They also want to ensure that globally, there are kind of like these, protocols that they're all following that ensure that everyone has the same information. They're all working from the same kind of data. So, I did get the feeling that although these are private companies, there is almost kind of like this global force for good. Although I should sort of, you know, a small addendum that maybe F-Secure won't sort of thank me for. But I did also talk to sort of one researcher at the University of San Diego who kind of like questions the numbers that the security companies, the virus companies, do put out there. He thinks it's much, much lower than they suggest. And also he suggests that a lot of the government numbers we read are frankly just, you know, pie in the sky numbers that are made up by extrapolating certain data sets and then kind of multiplying them in various ways to do with, you know, IP theft or whatever. So I'm sure that, you know, there is a real danger here, but, you know, there is also, I guess, an interest, shall we say, from security companies to ensure that we're all aware of that danger, if just to balance things out.
Well, in that case, let's end on a small number then, because you asked Mikko who's at risk, and there's a great quote here in the feature which says, "The total amount of Apple computer malware is still very small, a fraction of 1%, meaning a few hundred Mac OS X Trojans or backdoors compared to tens of millions for Windows malware. We see more mobile phone malware than Mac malware, so you're more likely to get hit on your Android device than necessarily a Mac." So really what we're saying here is use a Mac, don't use Android, and stay safe.
Definitely stay safe.
Greg Williams, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Nate. Enjoyed it.
Thanks again, Greg. And that feature is in the current issue of Wired, which is on newsstands now. You can recognize it by the big picture of Reid Hoffman on the front, staring at you, beaming.
Looking like an evil superhero.
Yeah. It's also on the iPad as well. So if you go to the iTunes store, search for Wired UK, you can buy it there as well. That's going to do it for this week's show, isn't it?
But before, you want to tell people about that competition you mentioned?
Oh, yes, we do. Yeah, we're giving away a Sony Tablet S, which is a tablet computer, and you can win it by going to wired.co.uk/competition.
Delightfully unspecific.
Not the iPad.
It's a not iPad tablet. And yes, go to wired.co.uk/competitions. We have a question with a very easy answer that you can Google.
There's probably quite a lot of listeners who don't really care about the iPad at all, and they'll probably be quite excited by this.
Yeah, so we've got a Sony Tablet S, and we want to give it away.
That's
so
for you guys who aren't Apple fans.
Exactly. Go and win it. And Liv's going to tell us how you can get in touch to tell us how you feel about this potential winning.
I'm just thinking of the word win it now, which has an entirely different meaning. But anyway, you can follow us on Twitter. We're on @WiredUK. And we've also got a fantabulous Facebook page. It's on facebook.com/WiredUK.
Yeah, we give stuff away on that as well.
We do.
Yeah,
we do. And you can email us podcast@wired.co.uk. We love to hear from you. It is always delightful when messages ping into our inbox.
You can also call us. Duncan, what's the number?
The number is, I'm not going to sing it again, 0208 123 0468. And if you want that slightly slower, it's 0208 123 0468.
Call us. Leave us a 30-second message. Say something nice and we'll play it on the show next week. But anything we've talked about at all, Liv, Duncan, the pleasure has been all yours. Next week. Bye.
Bye.
Yeah, but you wrap your legs around it and bounce.